Thank you all very much. I want to thank all of you today for this tremendous honor of keynoting your annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. celebration. And I also want to thank the student body, faculty, and leaders of the African and African American Resource Center for spearheading this wonderful event. And it's always good to be back home at Northeastern. I'm also happy that the King holiday is celebrated in the month of his birth, because if it were March or April of this year, we might have to be giving the speech outside, since Governor Bruce Rauner, who also went to Dartmouth, after me, I can't believe I'm older than he is, you know? But I look so much better, right? Since he's unable to balance the state budget and put a number of public institutions in harm of closing their doors, Northeastern may be fine for now, but brothers and sisters, I implore you to join in solidarity with the faculty, staff, and students at Chicago State to help them save their university. If one of us is unsafe, all of us are unsafe. This governor's turnaround agenda is not good for Illinois. It's not good for working families. It's not good for single parents, students, children, the aged, or the disabled. It's only good for billionaires and the venture capitalists. People who refuse to pay their fair share. But if you haven't felt the impact of his misguided policies, don't worry, you'll have your turn. How do you cut funding to autism on World Autism Day? Yeah. How do you do that? You're a sociopath. That's how you do it. There can be no fence straddling, not in Illinois and certainly not in Chicago. Look around. The 1% aren't going anywhere, and they don't give up that easily. You can either chant, cut us in, or cut us out. Choose a side. Choose a side. There's a reason a single lyric from an iconic civil rights song has become the mantra of the 21st century youth who are in the streets all over the country fighting police violence. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Je suis sur le côté de la liberté. I'm on freedom side. So it is quite fitting that I'm asked to talk to you this afternoon about my favorite topic, social justice. In celebrating the life of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., it is also fitting that we ask ourselves the reflective question, what is social justice to me? It's getting off your behind and taking action when you see wrongdoing in your community and the greater society. People seem to marvel at our style of leadership, and perhaps it's because we're blunt, and specifically me. So you know, when black women reach that certain point and that certain age, we tend to get straight to the point. We don't waste a lot of time with semantics. Get off your behind and do something constructive. Be a change agent. And that's not someone tendering bills at the local currency exchange. Our leadership was born out of the need for reforms, externally and internally. In order to take on the Board of Education, we had to change how our local operated. The Chicago Teachers Union was a lukewarm organization that barely opened its mouth about the injustices done to its members, let alone our students, parents, and greater society. Rarely said anything about poverty or race or violence or how these things impacted the classroom. But educators were getting hammered by the Board of Education, and the rank and file had become sort of apathetic and afraid of authorities who could basically end their careers with a stroke of a pen. The bad teacher narrative was popularized and promoted. Our dignity was slowly being stripped away. But you know, at some point, people get tired of having a foot on their necks. And that's how my caucus, CORE, the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, came into being. Our necks were hurting. We were a little study group, just a bunch of educators who decided to get together and look for solutions. Solutions in pages of books we enjoyed. We were angry and frustrated, but united in our belief that inaction and silence was just as bad as being complicit in our own demise. Collective bargaining did not have to mean collective suffering. So we organized. We protested. We decided to take on the CTU status quo leadership, and without any expectation of winning, oops, we did. And so now at the helm, the fight was on, not just a fight for our bread and butter issues, but the fight against the 1% austerity agenda. Now, mind you, this is going on worldwide. The attack on teachers unions is not particular to Chicago or the United States. This is something that's been going on at least since 1973 in Chile. We work to preserve our labor rights and to protect our profession, but we also fight for the schools our children deserve. And in order for our students to have the schools they deserve, we understand that we must address all forms of inequalities, including poverty, neighborhood violence, poor nutrition, unemployment, classism, and racism. Yes, I said them all. How can we say we're fighting for our students if we lack the moral courage to say something about the fact that over 160 schools have no libraries, or that there's a lack of wraparound services for our students, or of all the black high schools in Chicago, only 3 have an actual librarian in the building? How can we not say something about the structural inequalities in our school district, the lack of revenue solutions, and the horrific school funding formula? How could we keep our mouths closed about privatization and dismantling of public education and other public services? How could we not say words such as democracy and justice and direct action? How could we not say that? What kind of social justice do we believe in if we allow lies, myths, and half-truths about the business of teaching and learning to dominate the public discourse? What kind of educators would we be if we did not correct the public narrative? So in the beginning of our efforts to strengthen the CTU, there were only a handful of us. Now there are many. And we've picked up some allies along the way. But you know, social justice only requires one person who will stand up, take action, do something, fight back. Just one, and it should be you. So what does it mean to celebrate the legacy of a man who gave his very life to others? One who died standing up against racist oppression, a man who died fighting for organized labor, because that's what he was doing. That's what he was doing. Who was he, and how does that life inform my own work as president of the Chicago Teachers Union? And in reflecting upon Dr. King's legacy, of how I can be confident that I'm remembering him as he truly was, and not as the editors of history have imagined him to be. Thank you. Excuse me. As we gather to celebrate the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I'm reminded through his speeches and other works that he always gave credit to the men, women, and youth who put their lives and property on the line for justice. He never took all the credit for himself, even as he became the face of the movement. His faith in those around him, his family, his staff, his colleagues, even his political contemporaries who disagreed with his style of engagement, never wavered. He truly loved his people. When Martin Luther King received a Nobel Peace Prize, he donated every dime to the movement. He didn't live high on the hog. I've read that he owned only 3 suits. I don't know if that's true or not, but I certainly have heard that. And that he believed that people should never live above their means. I'm one that pays my bills off every month. I just can't give them that extra dough. I can't do it. And those of you with student loans, pay that. Don't just pay the minimum. I promise you, if you can, do something better. But Dr. King felt that materialism was another sort of evil, and one that corrupts the human spirit, much like absolute power. Reverend King was a radical. He wasn't narcissistic. If you listen to the sanitized version of his life, you would think he was born in a manger and that he single-handedly fought Jim Crow, obtained voting rights by a single act of registration, and then ran off to take on the issue of Vietnam all by himself. No. Dr. King often lifted up the names of everyday men and women whom he met on the picket lines and in bridges. And these are the people that toiled with him in the jail cells, who strategized with him in their churches and kitchens. He ate in their homes. He knew their children. He debated and argued with them from time to time. And he worshiped with many of them, too. He also understood the importance of celebrating and guiding the young leaders on his staff, such as Andrew Young, Hosea Williams, Jesse Jackson, all of whom were being pressured by young people of their age group to abandon King's nonviolent philosophy and join them in more militant actions. He kept close to Reverend Ralph Abernathy, his friend and confidant, and shared a brotherly bond with him as they protested, faced guns and water hoses, and were hurled into darkened jail cells. He sought the counsel of wise advisors and often consulted with his elders before engaging in courses of action. Yes, the sanitized King is a lone wolf who did it all by himself. The radical and revolutionary King, though, was truly a man of the people. The concocted King was adored by the press, welcomed everywhere he went, and was greeted by singing bluebirds and butterflies all along the way. The radical and revolutionary King was maligned in the media until the day he died. The FBI planted false stories on him. His mugshot was plastered on the front pages. Doors of churches pastored by men of his own skin color were closed to him. He was called a troublemaker and an outside agitator. There were no singing birds and rainbows anywhere. Dr. King was often granted with racial slurs, jeers, rocks, death threats, and other profane words, even when he was praying on bended knee. The make-believe Martin Luther King Jr. was a loving, passive, smiling Christian who followed Jesus and was a simple do-gooder who preached his way into the history books. The real king believed Jesus was a revolutionary, and it was because of his Christian faith that he must act to destroy white supremacy, racial bigotry, economic and social violence. He loved all people, yes, but his first commitment was to his own, the sons and daughters of former slaves, the people he saw overcoming bad public policy and unjust laws in his dreams. The sanitized kings sealed his place in our history books through his death at age 39. The unfiltered Martin Luther King Jr. can be found in a 13-year span of his short and compelling life. It is a living that challenges our thinking and our doing, and one that calls the question, what is social justice to me? The made-up Reverend King was celebrated by every generation, loved by everyone all the time, all of whom magically marched with him throughout the South. These folks put pictures of a smiling or pensive hero on their wall, in between portraits of John F. Kennedy and Jesus Christ, now that he's dead. The Radical King was called an Uncle Tom by black youth while he was alive and was one of the hundreds of organizers who took the highways, they took to the bridges, the streets, and state capitals to exert their human rights and dignity. These individuals had courage, not the kind of courage it takes to post anonymous rants on social media or create memes attacking targets. Dr. King had audacity, just like Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker and Rosa Parks. The sanitized king is remembered as being weak and unable to keep up with emerging black voices. The real king spoke clearly to his younger freedom fighters when they said, "Burn, baby, burn." Martin Luther King Jr. said, "It must be build, baby, build. Organize, baby, organize. Yes, our slogan must be learn, baby, learn, so that we can earn, baby, earn." What does social justice mean to the Chicago Teachers Union? For us, it means the constant pursuit of racial and economic democracy. It means standing up for the disinherited. It means making some people very uncomfortable. In February of 1968, 2 months before his death, King said to a gathering, "The vast majority of Negroes in our country are still perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. My friends, we are living as a people in a literal depression." Now, you know, when there's mass unemployment and underemployment in the black community, they call it a social problem. When there's mass unemployment and underemployment in the white community, they call it a depression. But we find ourselves living in a literal depression all over the country as a people. And as if he were in the fight, in the middle of the Fight for 15 rally, he went on to say, "Now the problem is not only unemployment. Do you know that most of the poor people in our country are working every day? And they're making wages so low that they cannot begin to function in the mainstream of economic life of our nation. These are the facts which must be seen, and it is criminal to have people working on a full-time basis and a full-time job getting part-time income." So that's what Dr. King did. He made people very uncomfortable. And through all of his efforts, he never sought to deify himself. That's happened in the wake of his death. He has become a god-like figure, unreachable and unreal. Dr. King was America's conscience, but he was also a flawed human being. It is important that we demystify his person so that we can thoroughly examine his legacy through the proper historical lens. When the creators of the new, more likable king seek to turn him into an untouchable holy martyr, it is those who are the embodiment of his legacy who must correct that narrative. And why? Because when we deify Dr. King, we tell children and emerging activists that the things he accomplished during his lifetime are attainable, unattainable, and otherworldly. That's why we have to demystify and tell the truth about him. Dr. King was a mere mortal. 6 years ago, I was a high school chemistry teacher who went home every day after work and socialized little. And 6 years ago, I was working at a school named for Dr. King. So I got to meet people periodically who worked with him and would tell us the truth. They tell us he smoked, drank, and cursed, and, you know, chased girls every now and then. But we aren't supposed to know that. And we aren't supposed to appreciate that he was human like all of us are. So my entire life back then revolved around what happened in my classroom. Today, my life and my work has obviously changed. I feel like the same person I was when I started on this journey. I may look different, which is a good thing. And I may have had some health difficulties. And you all know about them. But to me, I am the same Karen Lewis, Coach John Lewis's wife, who walked into CTU and sat in the president's chair. There are members who sometimes look at me as if I walk on water. I can guarantee you I do not. I'm just a single person who was sick and tired of being
sick.
There you go. And joined with a group. People know they're Fannie Lou Hamer, huh? Okay. And I ended up joining a group of people who knew something and wanted to do something about it. We saw injustice and we said something about it. We organized about it. We took action. This is what Dr. King did, along with hundreds of others, during the 50s and 60s. He was a pastor, a husband, a father who stepped into the limelight at the age of 26 that he did not create. Segregation, racism, violence, and man's inhumanity to man created that spotlight. Karen Lewis did not create this spotlight. The austerity agenda did. There's nothing special here, nothing mystical and magical about what we're doing. We are a union of teachers, paraprofessionals, and clinicians who are bound together as laborers. We're workers. We're education workers. But guess what? We believe in research. We believe in organizing and strong communications. I am but one of the four elected leaders, and there will come a day when someone else will lead at CTU. People assume that leaders are the most moral, most honest, most ethical of all beings, and that they rarely make mistakes. In the practice of charismatic leadership, people who deem themselves followers of this sort of personality automatically bestow the highest honors and praise upon the person out front, even if they don't know them at all. It is extremely curious behavior. And then when the leader stumbles or makes an error or really screws up, the so-called follower takes it personally. Why? Because in their mind, the person out front must be the most moral, ethical, nicest, smartest individual, or why else would they lead? It has been said that no man is a hero to his valet. I didn't make that up. The sanitized Martin Luther King was everybody's hero. The real and rebel King made mistakes, ticked people off, and was not a perfect man. I believe he knew who he was, And clearly he knew what he was, and that was someone not to be stepped on by the system. Do you know who you are? What does social justice mean to you? Democracy, freedom, integrity, fairness, equity, community. Are these just words we say to one another to sound progressive and sane in the era of madness? Or do we embody the historical traits of a Martin Luther King? Honesty, love, compassion, critical thinking, self-sacrifice, and commitment. Like so many people, we probably want to be remembered as king-like, hailed and celebrated by millions, but only without his sacrifice, because we don't want to go that part. We want the flowers, not the fight. We want to marvel at ourselves in the mirror and think how great we are and that we did it alone. How many times have you heard that? I'm a self-made man. I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. No one does anything alone. No one. No one pulls themselves by any bootstrap. Teachers play a tremendous role in your life. You didn't do it all on your own. A parent, a grandparent, a relative played a role in your life. Some ancestor who you will never know prayed for you and wished upon a distant star that you'd be right here where you are right now. You can't do it alone. You're going to need someone along the way. We struggle together. We celebrate together. We must live in this place together. Or as Dr. King said, we can perish separately as fools. As we watch the events unfolding in this city, no matter your political position on who is right or wrong, understand that in some point in your life, you will have to ask the question and answer it. Where was I when all of this was going on? Safe? Hiding? Getting down on Facebook? Or did you stand with the oppressed? Did you open your mouths? Did you advocate for your own cause? Did you take up the mantle of social justice? What does social justice mean to you? How does Dr. King influence your life? How does he influence your advocacy? By the time he died, the drum major for justice was the most dangerous man in America, an honor bestowed upon him by his own government. He was hated, persecuted, lied upon, maligned, jailed, beaten, and eventually assassinated. We don't want to think of ourselves as that Martin Luther King. We want to think of ourselves as the other king, the sanitized one, the one with the national holiday, whose pictures is on the wall, whose words are quoted, and whose name is revered. No, we want a Martin Luther King celebration, not the Martin Luther King suffering. The civil rights icon reminded us, everybody can be great because everybody can starve and everybody can serve. You don't have to have a college degree to serve. You don't have to make your subject and verb agree to serve. Doesn't hurt you though. You only need a heart generated by grace. A soul full of love, service, sacrifice, suffering, and then silence. Now, the Martin Luther King we have is sanitized and commercialized. His image is etched in marble and part of the National Mall for all to see. The radical Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was spied on by his own government, one that may have been complicit in his murder, was a radical revolutionary and was a pariah to governments who hated to see him coming. Few of us if any of us can live up to the homogenized, saintly version of this civil rights icon that has been created by Madison Avenue, the federal government, and the people who would have never invited him or his family inside their church, temples, or mosques to worship with them. He preached resistance before reconciliation. He didn't believe in sleeping with his enemy, meaning he said one thing in public to the people who looked to his leadership, but privately he was in bed with his oppressor. He bore revolutionary witness. Which side are you on? And what is social justice to you? Thank you. Thank you. I'm good.
So we're going to take the time to open it up for Q&A.
Hi, my name is Lorena. I am a member of Anak Bayan USA, which is a comprehensive national democratic Filipino organization. And I just came back from Seattle from a congress and conference we organized. I was wondering what your position is on solidarity. You spoke about struggling together, fighting together, and living together. And I guess we are trying to wage this campaign where we want to fight for education, not the commodification of it, but also on how budget is being created, where it's primarily for militarization as opposed to education, because the money that is being sent to militarize is being sent to militarize my people. $70 million was actually of our taxpayers' money was sent to the Philippines. And just the other day, another 15-year-old, and there's been 20-plus children in the Philippines that were killed using the taxpayers' money. So regarding the question, I guess I would just like to ask your opinion as far as like how we could go about waging this campaign here locally, knowing that the issue is abroad. As someone from CTU, well, as a leader of CTU, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are that people of like minds find each other, but you have to go looking. You know, you can't just sit here and say, here I am. There are a lot of organizations that are working towards the demilitarization of the police force, the demilitarization of our schools. It's also something that Dr. King was very serious about. The key is to start reaching out, talking to people, and telling them your story. And that's what this is all about, is that we create our own narratives. And when we do that, we change the dominant narrative. So when you say, did you know that $70 million of our taxpaying money went to kill children in the Philippines? People go, no, I didn't know that. And then all of a sudden, you'll pique somebody's interest who will want to study more. The key is arming yourself with research. That's one of the proudest things that I think I am of the Chicago Teachers Union. When we took over in 2010, we did two things. We cut the officer salaries so that we could have an organizing department to internally and externally organize, but also we got a research department. You can't say you should have more money for funding schools unless you have a solution for doing it. We can say that all day long, but if we don't have solutions and we don't develop them and we don't study and put our brains to work, because that's what teachers do, right? Don't we do that? So the key is we're teachers. We study the problem, we try to solve the problems. So the key is to have those conversations. Reach out to some of the organizations near you. Look at some of the neighborhood organizations, the Albany Park Neighborhood Association. There are just quite a few that are willing and ready and able and already organized. Logan Square Neighborhood Association. There are all kinds of neighborhood organizations throughout the city that are looking at these issues and trying to offer solutions to the problem. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for endorsing CPAC as well.
So. Next question.
Hi. Is this on?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Well, my name is Terry Albano. I'm a senior here at Northeastern, and thank you for your leadership and commitment, really, to public education and unions and all of that. My question goes to the very scary state of the state budget and what this governor in particular wants to do to public education, higher education. Chicago State University could close its doors.
In March.
That's right, end of February, beginning of March. And, you know, Northeastern is maybe not quite there yet, but we could be, and so could Western, so could Northern Illinois, all these state universities. Plus, then he wants to take over CPS. So I'd like to know what, if any, concerted efforts that CTU and others are doing, because I think a bunch of us would like to join that effort.
Thank you. When people ask me stuff like that, I like to say, oh, CTU is doing nothing. You know, we're just nothing. We organize against these fools every single day, okay? You have to take on the power structure by looking at the way the game is played, okay? I think the last time I was here, I think I asked those of you, I see a couple of you that look familiar. I asked three questions. And the three questions I kind of stole from Lonnie Guinier. And these three questions are, you know, what are the rules of the game? Okay, so if the rules of the game are electoral politics, then guess what? We're going to have to play in electoral politics. So the key, though, is who made the rules to the game? Because whoever made the rules has the advantage. Never forget that. So you have to know who made the rules to the game and what their agenda is. But the third question you have to ask yourself is, how do the winners keep the losers playing the game? And that's something that I don't think we ever think about enough. We don't interrogate what are the stories the winners tell the losers to keep them playing the game. So part of it's politics. You have to develop relationships. Every single person here should know their state rep and their state senator by first name basis. You should have their numbers on speed dial in your cell phones. They should know you because you're a voter. I can't tell you how many times I come into a place this size and people don't know who their state reps or their state senators are. And they'll tell you, I never got any phone calls from any of my constituents. So the key is to develop a relationship with your state senator, your state representative, because when they get ready to make a decision on something, they should be looking to you as the expert instead of some high-paid lobbyist or something of that nature. You should make yourself aware. Bring them bullet points of information. That's the beauty of the internet. Man, I am so glad I have lived long enough to be here. By the way, I went to Kosminski Elementary School, which they're trying to close, and I'm surprised they didn't. But, you know, it's one of those things where you have to educate yourself so that you can educate others. It's just that simple. And it's not a hard task, and that's what we do at CTU.
So we'll take a question here.
How you doing?
My name is
Memory Pines, and it's ironic that you're here today because this morning before I left out to school, I was speaking to my mother, who is 85 years old, and she was comparing you with Jackie Vaughn. And I mean, that is... And what I get out of my mother is that she's real sharp in the mind. She's quick. You know, if I had the education that she has, I'd be a very bright, intelligent person. I'm talking about my mother is sharp.
Your mother doesn't need the education. She got it herself.
Yes, she did.
You know? Yeah, she's bright and sharp.
Yes, she is. And I appreciate that. The young lady asked part of the question I wanted to ask, but I also wanted to ask you about the governor and Rahm, which we know should eloquently step down. And
Oh, yeah, that's going to happen.
And let that move on. I wanted to ask about the dismantling of the groups that they want to dismantle. We know that you have been ill, and we all pray for you, and all women and people that's battling with cancer. But do you think that you will step back into the governmental?
No. And not because I've been ill. I mean, even though that has a lot of factors, you know, to stop me, I'm in a way, I cannot say that I'm happy I got cancer, because I certainly am not. But it did put life in perspective for me. And I'm not bad enough. I mean, I'm a bad dame. Don't get me wrong. I get it. But I am certainly not bad enough to try to deal with all this mess that's going on right now that I would inherit. So, no. But I will tell you this. I want to say to you that and let you know that I have reached a very important milestone in my fight with this disease. As of the beginning of this month, the first Tuesday in January, I reached the 15-month timeline of diagnosis to where you are. 17 to 20% of the people with my disease do not make it that long.
Congratulations.
So, yes, thank you. And I'm a fairly religious person. I didn't realize that for a long time, but I'm fairly religious. And by the grace of God, I'm standing here in front of you. And that is a person who, you know, spent most of my adult life as a atheist/agnostic, and then discovered Judaism, which really works for me. And, you know, I was bat mitzvahed, and I had a wonderful time doing that. Are there any Jews in the audience? You know what it's like going through a bat mitzvah at a grown person's age, at 60? It's so much better than 13. Just got to tell you. So my health is good. You know, I'm doing really well. But I'm done with chemo. I'm done with radiation. I'm done with all that stuff. But I will tell you, I have such a low tolerance for BS. You know? Not that I didn't have it before. But now it's like, okay, thank you. You know? It's really hard for me to, you know, sit through some of the garbage I have to sit through. But, you know, it's part of being a grown person.
The governor wants to dismantle the unions.
Especially
the teachers union.
I don't know why he hates me so much.
But yeah.
Don't you feel like he's obsessed? I mean, it's like Karen Lewis, this Karen. Why
and
is
what
my
can
name
we do to strengthen
mouth?
It? And what can we do as parents and students to strengthen your union? You know, just because we're not teachers, we should be able to help.
Oh, God. And thank you, because we rely on it. Our natural allies are our parents and our students. You know, those are our natural allies. You know, how many people are here in the education department? How many people are learning to be teachers or teaching teachers? First thing I tell you is develop strong relationships with your parents. It will make your school life so fabulous. And you can't tell them that your child is driving you crazy. You know, that's not the thing you tell them first. You always tell them how great their kids are, how wonderful they are, even if it's a lot, tell it, you know, because it's worth it. And then you get that kid aside and say, see how I did for you? That was me. Did I get you in trouble with your mother? No, I did not, but I could. See, because we have it like that now, you know. Then you have no more trouble out of those kids, I promise you.
All right, Aaron.
She already said my name. but I have to say, with all the stuff that's going on right now, like what happened with the Laquan McDonald tape being covered up and all the corruption going on, getting widespread attention right now, I actually do believe that A change is going to come. Do you think a change will come eventually?
Yes. But I'm also optimistic. I am a person who believes the glass is always three quarters full. I really do. I mean, I think that's gotten me to where I am today, period. You know, I've had a lot of challenges in my life. But, I mean, to me, the only black woman in your class at Dartmouth, that's a challenge. And I made it through. Don't ask me how, but I made it through, you know? So the key is, yes, a change will come. But it's not going to come because we're sitting here quietly hoping for it. A change comes because of direct action, because we get up and we take to the streets and we interrogate those who are in charge. And we hold them accountable. They always talk about holding us accountable. We need to have that accountability going both directions. So yes, I do believe a change is going to come. And it will be led by the youth, I hope.
Good evening. So Sunday, there was a couple of programs that aired, you know, stories on Dr. King. I think I caught the tail end of a Tavis Smiley show. He mentions in his book, As the Trumpet Sounds, that he sort of wished he could have done something different in his movement. Do you know what those things could have been?
That Dr. King did?
Yeah.
I mean, Dr. King, people have to realize that he had a lot of things he was really working on that, of course, it got cut short. So he was very interested in nonviolence, of course, but he was interested in it on a global level. He wanted to see the end of war. He thought the war in Vietnam was an immoral act, and everybody told him, sit down, don't talk about that, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of people think that that was one of the reasons he was assassinated. But he was also very interested in economic justice. The March on Washington was the poor people's march. It was the poor people's march. People forget that. And that's what it was. So his desire to do more was to sort of get out of the preaching mode and into the change agent mode.
Okay. Thank you.
And at least that's, let me put it to you that way. This is how I recall it, because I was pretty sentient in 1968. Mm-hmm. I was in high school, so. Okay. You know, and we were walking out. Is there anybody from here that remembers those Mondays we walked out of high school in Chicago, all across the city? Yes. You don't remember. You put your hand down. You youngsters up there.
Thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you so much.
Next question.
Hi. Hey. Hi, my name is Elise McFadden, and I'm a social work major. First of all, I just want to say you are an amazing woman and an amazing spirit for you to battle cancer and, you know, go through what you're going through and then just stay so strong and just stand here and speak to us is just so encouraging, especially for me because I am a double transplant patient. So, like, there was a time where I needed a kidney and pancreas, but I got it. So God is good, right?
Mazel tov.
Hey.
Mazel tov.
But so what I'm doing is I'm taking in what I got and I'm passing it. I'm moving it forward, right?
Yep.
And I love your attitude when you're like, yeah, well, don't talk to me, okay? So that's, you know, and I have that personality, too. So now I'm in school.
Yeah, but you're a little young for
I'm
that.
30. I'm 30
gonna
years
have to
old.
Let them, you're going to have to let them clown you a little bit longer.
But you know what? I do understand that life is short.
Yeah.
And you got to get it while you can.
Yeah.
So, you know, with that said and done, I see how you have so much confidence and eloquence when you're speaking. How do you, like, maintain that? Because I
have no
sometimes
idea. I don't have any idea. I mean, this is just what I do. I taught school, you know, and this is the way I taught, you know. I mean, except for I didn't read notes, you know. I have one of my former students here. I mean, I just love communicating. I was always the kid that got the check for talks too much in class.
Yeah, right, that's me.
And works well and plays well with others. I always got that check. I'm bossy. That was on my kindergarten, you know, my kindergarten what's that report card said I was too bossy.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And I was like, but I had good ideas. And if the other kids,
right, exactly.
If the other kids just liked them and followed them, why did that make me bossy? I mean,
exactly,
it was,
right.
I wasn't mean to them, yeah, if they didn't want to do what I thought was the best way to do things. So, but in terms of, I don't know how I do this. I wish I could tell you, but, you know, just right. Speak from the heart.
And then one more quick part, right? So I'm going up. I'm getting a PhD. I'm doing it, right?
Oh, super mazel
tov.
So
I want to, you know, address the disparities in the healthcare system because mm-hmm. I've experienced that myself, like being on dialysis and seeing how, like, even how, like, not clean the dialysis, you know, it mm-hmm. was, and how certain people can't speak up for themselves and, you know, dealing with paperwork. It really, like, affected me. And I'm like, you know what? Give me my organs, let me get it, like, you know, let me get myself together, let me make this change, let me go back to school and do this. Like, how can I, like, you know, be able to maintain that and speak out, like, on the, you know, the macro level and just really advocate for everybody?
Well, I mean, that's not hard to do, to be honest with you. You need to put yourself in the position of, you know, 3 or 4 public health physicians. Like, you should know Dr. Linda Murray. You know, that's somebody you should know here, and somebody in this audience knows who she is and can get her in touch
can
with
you
this
raise
young
your
lady.
Hand? Anybody?
Somebody in this
okay,
audience
thank you.
Should know.
Okay, I found somebody.
But yeah, I'm sure they know her. Those are people you need to seek out and talk to, and be sure you do scholarly good work all the time. You know, that's the best thing, and be and have some integrity about your work. Don't take shortcuts. You know, because it will come. You know, mm-hmm. my only worry about youth is we like shortcuts. At least I did when I was young.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Now I'm like, okay, this is what I have to do to get from point A to point B to point Q. You know? So good luck with that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, I'm Nancy Matthews. I'm a professor in justice studies and the coordinator of our women's and gender studies program. So I'm very lucky. I get to teach about social justice all the time. You said something about direct action and taking to the streets, and I want to know if you think it's time for us to take to the streets in relation to this Illinois budget crisis.
Absolutely.
And what would that look like for those of us who want to do action. We did a big postcard campaign here in November and December. Nothing's changed yet. So I'm going to sit down, and then my former student, Giovanni Baez, famous NEIU guy, is following me. I'm so
former
excited about that, too.
Isn't that exciting? That's what we live for. I think the whole part of direct action is it really takes the ruling class by surprise because, you know, we're all supposed to be compliant. I think that's why they like charter schools and uniforms on kids. You know, I've always had that feeling that, you know, putting kids in uniforms. I hate uniforms for public school kids. I just do. And I have teachers and principals say, I really love uniforms for whatever reason they have them. I hate them because none of us are uniform. Every last one is different, you know, and so it's that whole notion of one size fits all. When I was really fat, I used to no, one size doesn't fit all, and I'm living proof of it. But they start taking notice when it's not just poor black people on the streets. They start taking notice when allies of every race, every color, every creed, every gender orientation start locking arms. And it's easy to do. It's not even that hard to do. There are church organizations. There are constituency organizations already willing, but they're kind of sitting around saying, well, how do we do it? One step at a time. One step at a time. And if it's only 3 of you, that's okay. That's a success. Next time it'll be 9. And the time after that, it'll be 200. You never know. When we started protesting, people were like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to that's so 60s. You know, I don't want to protest. You know, but it takes time and it takes patience. But you know enough people to call for an action and attack something that everybody can relate to. Go occupy Bank of America, you know, Stank of America, you know, whatever. You know, I mean, think about the small things. You know, support small business. Do not shop in Walmart. They can't have a nickel of my money. And I see all those good commercials and stuff I would want to buy. I'm sorry, I have to do without. So make your statements where you can. You're a teacher, study. Do the reading. We read Naomi Klein. You know, I'm reading Adolph Reed right now, Class Notes. I'm reading Teacher Wars. I'm reading all kinds. Well, I read like about three or four things at once. And I totally annotate everything. It's like, and then what happens is you start meeting other people who have read the stuff you're reading. Or, you know, that's one thing I love about Facebook. People always put these really great articles up that you can go click on and go read. And then now that's in your brain. So lock arms, one step at a time.
Hello, my name is Giovanni Baez. I'm a recent graduate in December.
Mazel tov.
I am, thank you. I am also a product of the Chicago public school system, and I'm happy that I was a product of them. My question would be, you know, from a cultural background in my community, we have the majority is, you know, Latinos. What I've been challenged as a community leader who wants to go out and, you know, help out my community is that most of the Latinos in my community are scared. They're challenged with the idea of them either being sent back to where they came from.
And most of the teachers that teach in Chicago public schools are scared.
Yep, exactly.
Fear is an important thing to acknowledge. So I just wanted to say yes to that, understand that, but then there's a way to utilize it to your advantage.
A lot of people are, you know, challenged with overcoming, is getting over the fear and actually going out there and making a stance for their own people.
Which is why you don't do things by yourself.
You don't.
That's the whole key. When you're, and that's why they want to destroy unions, because we don't speak as one, you know, in terms of one person standing out there. We got our sisters and brothers with us. That is very threatening. So the key is nobody's alone in this. Nobody gets anywhere by themselves. But if you have a vanguard of people out in front of them first, who they can't deport, then they're in the back row. You know, that's how you start. And then they'll get tired of being in the back row, trust me. I'm going to tell you what, fear. I got to tell you a fear story. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, I became frightened of driving on ramps. I don't know where it came from, but you know, like if you want to get on Lakeshore Drive and you want to get up on 55, you got to take a big old ramp. I couldn't do it. I just went through this space. My best friend lives off of the Harlem exit on 290, and it was such a hassle to get to her house because I had to go some other way because all of a sudden I was overcome by this fear. And then one day I had to get to a meeting. And the only way to get there is I needed to get on a ramp to get on the thing. And I got so angry that this fear was stopping me from doing what I needed to do. So that fear led to anger, and the anger led to action. Okay? I got to tell you, I put my car forward and I said, I am not going to let you stop. You know, and even though my heart was beating really fast, I got on that ramp. And I haven't had any trouble since, okay? But I had to take that first step. I had to just say, I can't let this hurt me. Now, clearly you don't want to separate families. And they have the right to be afraid. But if you have people that are not going to get deported on the front line and then the second line and maybe the third or fourth line, you have the right. They'll get used to it. And they'll start. You have to inoculate yourself to your fears. And the key is, we should be standing up for one another, period. Can't do it by yourself. Thank you.